Talk given Friday, 1st December 1972. There are just a few more points in connection with Varuna which we should understand clearly. Remember, fundamentally, Varuna is the embodiment of transcendent virtue, absolute virtue, this creative power which is perpetually in action, perpetual creation. It is transcendent karma, which has no consequence to it for the doer. It is acausal, it is free. And about Varuna, it is also said in another hymn, "The mighty ruler of these worlds beholds as though from close at hand. The man who thinks he acts by stealth, all this the gods perceive and know." One sees a resemblance here to the New Testament statement, "Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it." If a man stands or walks or moves in secret, goes to his lying down or his uprising, what two men whisper as they sit together, King Varuna knows. He, as the third, is present. In the ordinary way, the theologian will say this is a presentation of the omnipresence of God. But when we speak in those terms, this omnipresence of God is as if God were a separate entity. After all, let the devotee search his mind carefully, and he will find that he thinks of himself as here and God omnipresent in some mysterious way. He doesn't realize that God's omnipresence completely pervades one's being as an actual fact, just as space pervades our being. And it is an actual fact, speaking scientifically, materially. So too, that which we name God completely pervades our being all the time and is present there. Now, there's a tremendous significance in this for us. In our everyday life, you know how easily we say, "Oh, that's just a small thing, it doesn't matter." Or we say, "Oh, good thing, although I felt it so strongly or thought of it, I didn't say it. It would have been awful had I said it, and still more awful had I done something along those lines." But Varuna is transcendent virtue in me, which knows and sees everything. Now, it is because this transcendent virtue is in me, I, as the psychical being, decree my own reward punishment in the course of life. I inevitably do things which will bring about the full working out of that karmic energy. This is one of the great mysteries of our life. It is practically impossible for any human being actually to see in detail the rationale of it and the way it all works out. But it works. It works absolutely and inevitably. Now here we have to bear in mind something very important. Transcendent power, transcendent virtue, never compels. It never exacts anything from us. It never demands anything from us. It doesn't exercise any sort of will determining the actual course of our life. And this is the supreme mystery about it, that, to use theistic language, because it's appropriate to the Rig Veda, the will of God completely triumphs without ever exercising will in any shape or form that we humans understand will. You see, when the sense of transcendence awakens in us, we gradually become aware of this. This sense, transcendent power which works is the merciful justicia. If you want to relate this to the teachings of the Kabbalah, it's Hesed, Gevura, and Tifereth. Hesed, mercy, Gevura, judgment, and Tifereth, compassion, which mediates between mercy and judgment. You see? In an extraordinary way, this power in us inevitably works. It never punishes, it never rewards. Do bear that in mind. It is I who decree the reward punishment, and the conscious and the unconscious part of my psyche are involved in the interplay which produces the pattern by which this reward punishment business works out in our life. Now, you see the significance of Varuna as the embodiment of transcendent virtue. Because of the very presence of this transcendent reality in us, therefore, both justice and redemption take place. The law and grace both function and flourish. These are tremendous things. The logical intellect just reels before matters of this type. But you have to feel it. Let the mind in the state of calmness be sensitive to the reality, whatever it may be, and let not the mind demand that it shall know according to the norms of the method of knowing which the mind lays down. The mind is impotent there. But that aspect of the mind which has this sensitivity goes out towards whatever the thing may be, in perfect trust, in perfect confidence too, therefore, you see, and it works upon the mind, purifies it of the limitations imposed upon it by its conditioning, and enlightens it with the light that cannot be described. You see, the marvel and the beauty and the wonder of the religious life is really quite inexpressible. When these things happen in your innermost consciousness, you're utterly changed, you're utterly transformed. Only one who has been touched by transcendence itself looking at you will see, yes, here is one of them. It takes a skilled jeweler to evaluate a gem, doesn't it? How can the ignorant person look and say that, oh, this is a gem of the first luster or not, of the highest luster or not? The ignorant person can't do it. It takes a skilled jeweler to do it. So too, one who has been touched by transcendence, one who has known something of the reality of enlightenment, he knows. If one should flee afar beyond the heaven, note the statement, if one should flee afar beyond the heaven, King Varuna would still be round about him. that wonderful psalm. If I make my bed in Sheol, I shall find thee there. And what is that other lovely line? If I take the wings of the morning or something and my spirit fly, you see, I shall find thee there. What extraordinary truth about ourselves is hidden in the scripture. We must see it with eyes which can see. Proceeding hither from the sky, his envoys look, that is King Varuna's envoys look, thousand-eyed over the earth beneath them. And remember, King Varuna is here in one's own being. And the earth, whenever you get the word earth, one of its first meanings will be your own body. That is the earth in all the scriptures of the world. Heaven is the mind. The purified mind is the real meaning of heaven. Just one more verse about Varuna. Varuna sends and drives away diseases. Varuna is both native and a stranger. Varuna is celestial and is human. Now let us look at that. Varuna sends and drives away diseases. People believe that through the centuries, until modern science and so forth came along, and modern rationalism and all the rest of it, and said, superstitious twaddle, you see, that diseases are sent by some superhuman power to punish us. As the words stand, it seems as if that is the only way one can interpret it. But I have already said enough for you to be able to follow it carefully. That transcendent power which is present does not compel, does not decree reward punishment, but its very presence brings about the transformation of our dualistic, knotted up psychical energy and brings us to perfection inevitably. And it is in this process that the conscious and the unconscious part of my own psyche decrees reward punishment. Punishment is not quite the right word, and reward is also not quite the right word. It contrives to bring about that which will awaken me to truth, either through that which is wonderful, pleasant, beautiful, agreeable, acceptable, as well as that which is unpleasant, that which is catastrophic, that which is terrifying, and so forth. Both ways. When one sees that, really understands it, then one no longer runs after pleasure, nor does one cry out against the Lord for letting one suffer. You see, you take life in its wholeness in your stride, and you realize freedom from your own ambivalence into that state of perfection where only the transcendent reality functions through you, the living organism. This is very deep. Meditate on it. Meditate on it calmly, with the mind perfectly quiet, the mind inactive, in the sense of pursuing intellectually the meaning of things. Inactive that way, but extremely active in remaining alive, awake, watchful, and truth will reveal itself to you in all its fullness. That is the only way to understand religious truth. Well, we can now pass on from Varuna. There's a lot more, of course, but I just want to touch upon essential points with regard to Varuna. We next come to another of the great gods of the Rig Veda, namely Indra. Indra has been compared to the thundering Jehovah, has been compared to Thor of the Scandinavian mythology, and so forth. The comparison is perfectly justified. There are, of course, variations in each of the different concepts as presented. Indra is presented as sovereign amongst the gods. It is one of the curious things about the Rig Veda that all the great gods of the Rig Veda, the Adityas as they are called, I mentioned Adityas in our previous meeting, meaning that they are the children of Aditi. Aditi is the infinite. It means the unbound. And the gods of the Rig Veda are the children of Aditi. Now, the peculiarity about the Rig Veda is that whenever the seer, the Holy One, is writing, composing his hymn about a particular god, which actually means that he is expressing in that hymn his realization of that state of consciousness, in which the outstanding characteristic is represented, personified in the particular god. Now, each of these gods, when the seer writes about him, is the supreme god every time, which of course is most puzzling to any scholarly mind. Good heavens, I mean, At one moment in this hymn he says Varuna is the supreme god, and the next hymn he says Indra is the supreme god, the next one it's Brihaspati or Soma or Agni. Well, what is the truth about it? Well, of course, what is the truth about it? If only the scholar will see that God is not outside, but it is different aspects of himself, which, when playing the uppermost part in a particular circumstance and time, naturally is supreme. So he's perfectly right. He's literally correct in saying this is the supreme. Now, Indra's sovereignty is expressed, time and again. The largest number of hymns of the Rig Veda are to Indra, about 250 of them out of the whole collection of 1,017. So that just shows you what a tremendous position Indra has. Indra is king of all that moves and moves not, of creatures tame and horned, the thunder wielder. Over all living men he rules as sovereign, containing all as spokes within the felly of the wheel. That is, now, his power and his might. Here you have tremendous things said. Well, I won't read the whole lot. I'll read this verse. He who fixed fast and firm the earth that staggered, and set at rest the agitated mountains, who measured out the air's wide middle region, and gave the heaven support, he, O men, is Indra. Now, of course, everyone gives a naturalistic explanation. When you talk of mountains and air and earth, people think they are talking of this. Earth is this, the body itself. The middle region, according to the way the Rigvedic seers divided the world, which is your own organism, heaven is up here, the brain. The mid region is there, say roughly round the neck. It's the region of the mid-air, the antariksha, as it was called, and all the rest is earth. That is what they are referring to. Air is correlated to mind. See? So that's how one must read these hymns in order to extract their inner meaning. So now, Indra sounds as if he's a particularly important god. Now here in the last verse, even the heaven and earth bow down before him. Before his strength the very mountains tremble. Known as the Soma drinker, armed with thunder, who wields the bolt, he, O ye men, is Indra. Heaven trembled at the birth of thine effulgence. Earth trembled at the fear of thy displeasure. The steadfast mountains shook in agitation. The waters flowed and desert spots were flooded. Now, let us look a little deeply into the meaning and significance of Indra. Indra is specially known by two distinguishing titles. One is Bhagavan. Bhagavan means the bountiful one. He who pours out wealth, he who makes a man great and rich and prosperous and so forth. He is Bhagavan, the bountiful one. And the other title is Vritrahan. Han means the killer of Vritra, who is a demon, in the form of a serpent. Now we'll look into this rather carefully. Do remember, right through the Rig Veda, all the gods are prayed to by the seer in this way: give us wealth, give us cattle, give us kine, give us horses. Now the word for cattle is go, which is also a word for light. And the horse represents faculties of the mind, the power of the mind to penetrate into the inner reality, to fly to the heavens, Pegasus of the Greeks. If you're a Bellerophon, well, there you are, you can ride Pegasus into heaven. See? Now, think of these riches. Light, that is, enlightenment, and the flight into heaven, into the uttermost deeps and heights of the mind. Of the mind which is completely purified. Bellerophon cannot ride Pegasus unless he has complete control over Pegasus. You see? One has to bear all this in mind when reading the Rig Veda. Otherwise, it's hopeless. Don't waste your time over it. Now, that's in connection with his title of Bhagavan, the giver of riches. These are the riches he gives, spiritual riches. This is the power he gives, the power to enter into the deep realities. The other title, Vritrahan. Now we come to something very deep. I will try to present it as best as I can in a few minutes. The hymns state that the demon Ahi Vritra. Ahi means serpent. Vritra, in his demoniacal aspect, he withholds the waters. When Indra strikes the demon with his bolt, the waters are let loose. And as stated in that hymn, it's stated again and again in various hymns, the desert spots are flooded. They are made fertile. See? Now, let us link this up with the symbolism used in Hatha Yoga, the chakra symbolism. You all know about the chakra symbolism, don't you? The two highest chakras, highest only in point of where they are in the spine, in the body, are the Ajna chakra, between the eyebrows, and the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, which is associated with the brain. Now remember, these chakras are centers of psychical energy. Don't mix it up with the ordinary electrochemical processes and the physico-chemical energies of the physical body, which science knows of. Science doesn't know of these things. One day it will, actually. And I'm pretty certain that day is not far off now. Some of you in your lifetime will live to see it, you see. The Ajna chakra is the chakra where one hears the command of the master. The Ajna chakra, I would say, is the chakra which is associated with divine ideation. What in ordinary language we would call the thoughts of God. But thought, in the divine sense, is creative power. It is not a string of words. It is just creative power in action. This is what Ajna is concerned with. It is mind at its, in its supreme fruition at work. Divine, the divine mind in one. Now, Ajna is the last stage where one still retains separate self-consciousness. When you go beyond Ajna to Sahasrara, isolative self-consciousness is out. There is no differentiation between oneself and the totality. There is the full realization of oneself being integral part and parcel of the totality, with no isolative self-conscious element in that state of awareness. And that is Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus. That is the realm of the absolute silence. Indra is Lord of Heaven. Couple Ajna and Sahasrara together. This is Indra's realm. You yourself are Indra. Now, I've said a few things about Ajna and Sahasrara. Now you see what Indra represents in you yourself. It represents the absolute peak point of perfected, realized egohood, completely devoid of all egoism, of all separative self-consciousness. You are the true, the perfect individual. And the word individual means the undivided whole. And remember what I've said in recent months about this, that our true individuality consists not only in the wholeness of the particular ego, which oneself is, but the wholeness in which the purified self is in perfect and complete relationship with the totality, the whole universe. This is the ultimate individuality. This is the great meaning of the person as exalted in theistic religions. Understand it this way, and all the anthropomorphism and all the difficulties of the theistic presentation of God will vanish, completely vanish. And you will find that that truth, that is to say, the presentation of truth in that terminology, is identical with the other terminology of Brahman Atma. It's absolutely marvelous when you realize that. Now, Indra represents this. Because after all, remember that whilst you are alive, transcendence functions through you, the particular person on this earth, doesn't it? Therefore, there has to be the perfect egohood, which, because it is totally devoid of egoism, is completely unresisting to transcendence, to transcendent virtue, to transcendent wisdom, enlightenment, to transcendent love, goodness, and beauty. See, these are the deep things involved in the gods of the Rig Veda. And the same sort of thing applies to the other great pantheons, the Greek, the Teutonic, the Celtic, all of them. You can understand them in depth that way. And see how this applies to oneself. It is all inside oneself. It expresses the potentiality that there lies in each and every one of us, which can flower out. All right. Now, Indra slays the serpent. Now we must here understand that there is no actual slaying of any sort involved. And we must also understand that the serpent is presented in two ways. One is known as Ahi, that's the serpent, Budhnya, and the other is Ahi Vritra, whom Indra strikes at with his bolt. He strikes at with his bolt. Ahi Budhnya is the equivalent in the Rig Veda of what has been called the dragon of the deep. What is the dragon of the deep? The dragon represents life power, life energy. Life in its psychophysical sense, its purely biological sense, its psychological sense, and life in its transcendent sense also, as for example when it is expressed in the Chandogya Upanishad, when it is said Brahman is prana, Brahman is life. And in the theistic religions it is said God is eternal life, the everlasting one. God never dies. See? Now, this life power is the dragon of the deep. What is the deep? The deep is this infinite, well, I'm using the word infinite only in the sense of immense, this immense realm of the unconscious. That is the dragon of the deep. Out of this universal unconsciousness, there emerge points of light, which are the conscious points. The points of consciousness. And it is through those points of consciousness that all the potentiality that lies in the unknown, unconscious, find expression and give meaning to the process of fruition in the universal becoming process. So you see what is meant by the dragon of the deep. Now the dragon of the deep then is this life energy which is right through and through us in our transcendent aspect as well as in our human psychophysical aspect, in the infinite aspect as well as in the finite aspects. Now this deep is the source of the waters of eternal life. Let that deep be so stimulated that it pours forth the waters, which otherwise are, so to say, locked up, as if they were locked up. You see, they don't flow through yourself. Now, these waters are locked up as long as the sense of separate selfhood is powerful enough to shut out one's vision from the reality of totality and of transcendence. Now, where is this sense of separate selfhood strongest in us? Where do we express, manifest the assertion of separate selfhood and experience the satisfaction of egoistic power triumphing in us? Most of all, where? It is in our sexual function, whether we be men or women, it's the same. It's in the sexual function. Now look, if you were to take the chakras as such, the three upper chakras, the central one, which is at the heart, which represents you, the human, in the full sense of the term, and the three so-called lower ones, the one at the navel, at the genitals, and at the base of the spine. If you were to turn them up, you see, imagine you can sort of make a perfect U-turn with your spine, you see, and keep Anahata at the base, the heart center, and when these three face the upper three centers, the first chakra, which is the reservoir of this dormant life energy, faces Sahasrara, the transcendent itself. The one at the genitals, which is the chakra responsible for the supreme expression of separate egoistic selfhood, will face Ajna, the divine mind. And Manipura, which deals with the digestion, not only of food for the body, but of our experiences and our thoughts and our study for the sake of the psyche and the mind. That digestion goes on, doesn't it? What we call digesting our mental food and so forth. That will face Vishuddhi, which is the throat center, which is the center controlling speech. Now, all our ordinary speech in everyday life stems out of the activity of the three lower centers: food, sex, business. Well, isn't that so? That's the fact of our life. What do we talk about all day and every day? Food, sex, and business. Chatter, useless, worthless chatter from the standpoint of the fulfilled human. For me as a subhuman, that is perfectly normal conversation. Charming fellow, you know, beautiful conversationalist and all the rest of that rubbish. But when the purification has taken place and Vishuddhi now represents the speech, which is the expression of the functioning of transcendence, of divine mind, then it is prophetic speech. All right. Now, this the Svadhisthana, which is this chakra at the genitals, faces Ajna when you turn it up like that. Now, it is, as I said earlier, it is our sexual function which prevents the waters of inspiration, of divine life, of the spiritual realm from flooding our whole being. So what does Indra do? He strikes with his bolt at Svadhisthana, which is facing here, facing Ajna. Strikes with, is a poetic expression. He strikes with his bolt. He doesn't destroy the snake. This is the impression given by the hymns of the Rig Veda, but that is a bad way of looking at it. Nothing is destroyed. Everything is transformed, is perfected, is made marvelous. You look at the, in this world of ours, you look at the creative works of the great artists, composers, poets and so forth. They never destroy anything, they perfect it. Look at the work of a sculptor. You see, whatsoever is unnecessary is put into another place. And what is finally revealed and left there is the perfect statue, which looks as if it is alive. Now, this is what Indra does with his bolt. When he strikes at that sexual center, all separative, egoistic self-expression, and our sexual expression is the most powerful expression of our separative, egoistic nature, that is out forever. Now you see, if you really understand this, mind you, it's not easy. I've put it in words as clearly as I can. But if you really understand this, you will understand the whole significance, meaning, and the way to be celibate. Celibacy does not mean an unintelligent crushing of the sexual functioning in the whole psychophysical being. The people who practice celibacy in order that they may have a large banking account collected thereby through the years, then they'll go up to God and say, "Look, God, I've been a celibate. I haven't slept with anyone of the opposite sex. Now you've got to give me heaven for it in return." It's absolute stuff and nonsense. The day will come when human beings, you and I, understanding this, realizing it, purifying our souls, will still marry and give birth to Christs and Buddhas. Children have to be created by humans. They are procreated by the animals in unquestioning response to nature's impulse. We will create great humans by being completely at one with nature's method, but with the power and impulse of the transcendent behind it. A very different situation. There'll be no bondage or sorrow where sex is concerned. Understand this and look back into the Genesis story. The story in Genesis, when the Lord God says to Eve, "Thou shalt bring forth with pain. Thou shalt no longer bring forth with pain." But that's in the lap of the future. But it is people like us who, with understanding, set going the impulses which God knows how will come to fruition in the dim and distant future. That's one aspect of it. Now, when Indra strikes with his bolt at Ahi Vritra, Vritra no longer restrains the flood of the waters of life, of eternal life, and they flow freely and fertilize the entire psychophysical being. That's what Indra does. And remember, Indra is the personal Lord, the one who has come to full self-realization completely unegoistically. It is he who fertilizes the entire world field. And the first and foremost meaning always of the world field is your own psychophysical organism. Never forget that. If we understand this, we can never again have irreverence for the body, as we call it, or despise the body, or condemn the body, or the functioning of the senses. Now, this is what Indra does as Vritrahan. He is the great liberator thereby. So now I would like to stress, emphasize an important point. The conventional Hindu outlook is that Ahi, the serpent, especially Ahi Vritra, is an enemy to be overcome. That's absolutely the wrong approach. Ahi, the serpent in wholeness, is no enemy whatsoever. How can your own life energy be your enemy? If you haven't got it, well, there is no you. That's the end of the whole story. You see? Ahi in wholeness is no enemy. But this double aspect, so to say, I don't quite feel like using the word dual, because with the duality, you know one dual, you know the other dual. But here, in this double aspect, there is the vast unknown beneficent, and that is the small known, which undergoes the struggle of beneficent and maleficent. See? And without this dual thing, this small known dual, that vast beneficent cannot function, cannot work. See, I've said again and again, haven't I, that what is happening through the human kingdom is that transcendence is flowering out in self-realization. It's only through us that transcendence can do it. God has no mirrors at home. He wants to see his face with his eyes closed and with his imagination not at work as ours is. He longs to see his own face, and he knows somehow that that face is a face of infinite beauty and marvel. And it is through you and through me that God can see his own true face. And in order that this may happen, all this takes place through us humans. See this and let it be a power in your heart in daily life, and see how it completely transforms your daily life. Of course, the stress of the times in which we live and the circumstance in which we live is absolutely terrific nowadays. There's no doubt about that. It's greater than it was in past ages when things were a little more leisurely, a little more gracious and easy and so forth. But now it's very, very difficult. But you will not miss the bliss of it. Don't strive for it. Just let quietness steal into your heart. Just let it steal in there, quietness and peace. It will be there. And if you remember a phrase like this, which I have just said, let quietness steal into your heart, it will immediately be there. in the midst of awful turmoil in the office or wherever you may be. Even if you are held up an hour and a half in Oxford Street and the buses won't move because of the terrible jam, you won't feel like the Prime Minister wanting to blow your top off. Let it happen and see how things grow from within. Once the drought is over and the waters of life fertilize your whole world system, which is your own living being, once that happens, oh, marvelous fruits will grow. Now remember, when this happens, when Indra strikes his bolt at Ahi Vritra, the tree of good and evil in the Garden of Eden, which is our own being, and this tree is no other than the spine and the brain and the nerves, this tree of good and evil is now transformed into the tree of life. There will no more be need for flaming swords turning every way to keep Adam, myself, out of the Garden of Eden. The second Adam will have come to life within oneself. The Redeemer, the redemption is there. And then you will know, you will just know some of the things I have said again and again, that your inner being is actually constituted of happiness, of truth, of beauty, of virtue. It is constituted of those things. You don't have to search for them. You don't have to go chasing enlightenment. Well, we'll stop there today. I intended to deal with the god Agni and the god Soma also, but I always intend these things and they never come off. However, next time we'll go on with the other gods. But today we have considered something which, as far as I am aware, does not exist in writing anywhere, not in this form.